This is the story of a man who wanted to be Sultan instead of the Sultan. In June 1902, while European imperialism was slowly starting to shed its economic skin, as it was sinking its claws into Moroccan politics, the Sultanate in Morocco got catfished. Only back then we didn't have proper ID cards or documents, so the scam wasn't an easy one to uncover, to say the very least. And it grew to such proportions that it sparked the involvement of European powers, not only threatening the very authority of the Sultan over his subjects across the Moroccan territory, but even his legitimacy on the international scene got questioned as a result of this imposter. In this quite heavy episode of Moroccan history, the audacity, the nerve, the vision went by the name of a relatively young, educated, and ridiculously ambitious man who made the boldest claim of all. On the rooftops of the city buildings, from the top of Mount Zerhoun near Meknes to the feet of Wad Moulouya, the river, the main character of today's episode shouted that he was the rightful son of Hassan I, the late Sultan of Morocco who had passed in 1894, that he was the brother of the reigning Sultan Moulay Abdelaziz, a brother that had oddly gone missing ever since the 20-year-old ruler sat on the throne, where he was just starting to get comfy, by the way, after the death of the man who took on the regency for a couple years, Bahmed, which I made an entire separate video on my Instagram about. Check it out if you're curious about this story. It is a crazy one, too. This triangle between the governed, the governor, and an imposter that literally came out of nowhere, which slowly morphed into a square that included European powers, formed with its corners and angles the beating heart of the power dynamics at play in Morocco at the dawn of the 20th century. This is the story of Jilali bin Driss Tarhouni Youssefi, also known as the man with the donkey, Bouhmara. Jilali was born in 1860 during the war between the then ruling Sultan Sidi Abd al-Rahman and Spain. While some sources, very unreliable and shaky by the way, have stated he would have grown up in Oujda at the Algerian border, it is more likely that Jilali didn't grow up too far from the capital of Fez, where the game of politics used to be played. And according to Eugène Aubin, a French diplomat which was stationed in Morocco in 1902 and who collected a very substantial amount of information on what was going down in Morocco at the time, surprisingly pretty solid, according to him, Bouhmara was an Arabized Amazigh man. He was born in a small village called Ouled Youssef, located somewhat halfway between two of the most historical cities in Morocco, Fez and Meknes. His cradle, so to speak, the area he was born into, is surrounded by mountains, including Jbel Zerhoun or Mount Zerhoun, which can sound like a detail, but really it isn't, and we'll see why. Mount Zerhoun was known for being a very mystical place, where it wasn't uncommon for people to take part in all sorts of rituals, if you know what I mean. Even though he came from a very modest background, Jilali benefited from the ferment of that environment. His entire childhood was focused on education. He dipped his toes in the water of instruction by studying the Quran in a local school, which would later become a very common thing to do for Moroccans up until late 20th century, I would say. Then he joined the prestigious University of Al-Qarawiyyin in Fez in the promotion of Tulbat al-Muhandisin, meaning the student body of engineers, which, might I add, is the first thing close to a modern university in the entire history of universities. According to different sources, Bouhmara, or Jilali, would have traveled a lot for his studies, attending lectures possibly in the Parisian school L'École des Ponts et Chaussées. So not only was the man an academic weapon, but his studies also created a very unique link to Europe, a connection that, as we will see a bit later, will find its echo in his future ventures. Now, why am I boring you out with all these details about the education of Buhmara? Well, I think this section of the podcast is definitely one of the most important, because when we talk about figures like Buhmara, it is easy to fall into the trap of oversimplification. People often think of him as just a brute, right? A man that was driven by ambitious, force, brutality, who relied on violence and manipulation to achieve his ends. And while that might be true, to see him as just that would be to miss the entire point. Because his intellect and his education are the very reasons he represented such a threat to the Alawi dynasty. At that point, the Mkhzen in Morocco had been a powerful entity for centuries, even though it took some harsh punches during the 19th century, and a simple fool could never embody such a threat and such an opposition to the Mkhzen. In fact, what is quite surprising about the way things turned out for Jilali professionally is that, despite his very modest background and not having evolved in the city where the beating heart of power and politics lies, aka Fes at the time, his rise to political prominence was quick. Fresh out of university and likely after his travels, Jilali secured a job as a secretary to the office of Moulay Omar, the brother of the then ruling Sultan Moulay Hassan I. During the expedition of Sultan Moulay Hassan to the Tafilalt region, where his presence was needed to quark Siba, a tribal revolt, his brother Moulay Omar was appointed Khalifa of Fes, the capital. He hired a bunch of students who had graduated from Al-Qarawiyyin, and amongst those students was Buhmara. And it was during his service to him for his first ever job as a young man that Jilali bin Driss Zarhouni Al-Yusfi, I love to pronounce his name by the way, if you couldn't tell, got in trouble for the very first time. The first of many political intrigues his life would be paved with. Now, the exact nature of the trouble he got into is still unclear. The sources, which as always you can find in the description of the episode, do not provide many details on what exactly happened. But what we do know for a fact is that through all this manipulation and scheming that eventually landed him in prison for years, Jilali got caught up in a dangerous game. One that ignited the very ambitions which were bound later on to destroy him. For any man, prison can be an unexpected incubator, because in the confined spaces of prison, cut off from all distractions and the outside world that likes to play pretend, rotting in a cell in miserable conditions, his mind had no choice but to wander quite freely, as many years of education had trained it to. Isolation tones down the noise, sorts through the clutter, clears out the way for new burgeons of ideas to come in, to think of other ways to resolve an equation. For someone as Jilali, a young promising man who had his life ahead of him, who was dedicated at first to serve the Mkhzen, and who got involved in something so much bigger than himself, with no one coming to his rescue, because, and that was his lesson, working for the Mkhzen didn't mean he was safe from its thunder when it decided to strike. And one thing we can say is that these newly found feelings definitely choke his loyalty to the Sultanate to death. Once he got out of prison, Jilali didn't take time to rest, recharge, or heal. That wasn't really a thing back then. Instead, he went straight to a life of travels. After years spent behind four walls, trapped in chronic isolation with only his thoughts for company, the least we can say is that he needed to expand his mind. So Jilali set off, bitterness as his companion, wandered across vast plateaus and plains of North Africa, his hands buried in torn pockets, much like a certain French poet I greatly admire might have said. Gilali saw landscapes that stretched as far as the eye could see, but he couldn't survive on charity alone. Unemployed and blacklisted by the Mkhzin, the central power, Gilali knew he had to get creative. And creative he was. He started making a living as a marabout, playing tricks on people everywhere he went, staging miracles, and just like that, Gilali had crafted a mystical aura, carved out a name for himself amongst the so-called saints in the region. His ties with Mount Zerhon, as we've mentioned earlier, an area which was known regionally for its historical and spiritual significance, gave him a certain amount of added credibility, and the least we can say is that Gilali did not shy away from playing that card. But at one point, it really hit him. The way people reacted to him opened his eyes to the possibilities his newfound reputation offered him. This masquerade, what had started as a means to a material end, as a way to fund his travels, brought him such success that it inspired him to make claims that would only get more and more deceitful as he would get creative. So he did just that, spread different lies about himself, each more deceitful than the last. To the tribes he encountered in the Maghreb region, this man, who was visibly worn by a hard life despite his relatively young age, wasn't just a marabout anymore. He was also now a sharif. For those of you who might be unfamiliar with the term shurfa in Morocco, and pretty much everywhere in the Muslim world, if I'm not mistaken, are families that, at some point in their history, have claimed to be more or less directly the descendants of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. A very strong argument that earns anyone who tosses it around the immediate consideration, respect, trust, and loyalty of believers. In the history of Muslim nations, this has been a very delicate instrument of power to maneuver. And as lineage is something that can be very hard to trace, especially at the time, one should only approach this claim with a trembling hand. But humans being humans, a lot of people didn't, including our guy Gilali, without much concern, again, for the damage it might do to the integrity of the Muslim community in North Africa. But as Machiavelli once said, it is not titles that honor men, but men that honor titles. Do of that what you will. As time went by, Gilali started to go under the name of Buhmar, the man with the she-donkey, and while this rather funny title has quite a negative or amusing connotation in Morocco nowadays, to say the very least, and rightfully so, at the time and in these circumstances, it simply served as a reflection to the way Gilali was living his life during his travels. More often than not, he was seen with a she-donkey that carried his bags and material, going under a new name meant for Gilali taking a new identity, burying his past life, a life he didn't even bother to mourn. From that moment on, there would be no more Gilali bin Driss Zerhoni Lyousfi. All that was left of that man was a memory that was still haunting the walls of the prison where he had been. The memory of an isolated, powerless, and blindsided man. From then on, Morocco would only know him as Buhmara, and soon enough, it would also get a taste of his claws. Buhmara got the memo before the Gen Z did. The Lulu is the Salulu. The praise he experienced led him to foster the strong belief the circumstances were favoring him, that he had eventually built enough political momentum by now through years of travel to put it to good use. And by good use, I hope you hear leveraging it for his own gain. Strategic in the most sickening way, a compulsive liar, wounded, Buhmara was all of those things, but What really served as a stepping stone to the success of his future scam was how close he'd been to the people and to their aspirations, their demands, how aware he was of the ongoing crisis in Morocco that had worsened with the enthronement of Sultan Moulay Abdelaziz. The administration of Sultan Moulay Abdelaziz had been enforcing reforms that earned it a lot of popular backlash. And Bouhmara knew that. He was aware of the people's discontent, especially some tribes, including the tribe of Rieta. That would be his starting point. He asked for an audience with the leaders of the tribe and explained in great detail his plan to overthrow Sultan Moulay Abdelaziz, to climb the ladder of political prominence by pulling up the Rogi scam. Now you're like, what is this? For some context, during the 19th century in Morocco, anyone who tried to overthrow the Sultan and set up a new government without serious claims to the throne would essentially be called a Rogi. The term actually emerged during a particular situation that happened in 1862 when Jalil Rogi from the Safian tribe led a failed rebellion against Sultan Muhammad IV. And since then, the term had been used to designate similar threats so they could be more easily extinguished. The takeaway from that side note is that Bouhmara didn't just come up with that whole scam on his own. Told you he was a student. He was just reusing a mere tactic that had already been used before him. What's key to understand here is that the Alawi dynasty during the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, at the very least, was struggling hardcore to keep it together. The biggest challenge for the Makhzen, the central government, was to expand its control over the countryside so it could tax rural people more effectively. At the same time, the throne was shaking a little in its boots, with some heirs showing clear signs of powerlessness and an inability to control the traffic of guns and weapons, which were coming from both the Atlantic and the Mediterranean coasts. A traffic that was feeding the unrest across the country. So to have political elites in the country that are heavily armed and extremely influent makes it incredibly easy for local leaders like Madani Glaoui, for example, in his time, to stand their grounds against the sultans, to hold their own and to administrate a portion of land more effectively than the sultanate ever would or did. This political instability explains why it was relatively easy for European powers to sink their claws into Morocco. As we'll see in upcoming episodes, France and Spain, as well as others, truly like England or Germany, for example, first tightened their economic grip on North Africa before moving, for some, into the political sphere. And to make matters even worse, by the time Bouhmara was planning his move against the Sultanate, Sultan Moulay Abdelaziz was young and not exactly the sharpest tool out of the Alawi box, if you know what I mean. After relying entirely on his regent Bahmed until his death in 1900, he surrounded himself with a very westernized group of advisors. And instead of focusing on ruling like he's supposed to, Sultan Moulay Abdelaziz got caught up in all sorts of distractions that were presented to him by this very self-interested court of his. Western luxuries like fireworks, fancy gadgets, entertainment, you name it. His new tax reform, which was powered by the Europeans, sparked anger that was paired with the feeling that Europe was getting too involved in Moroccan affairs, which all contributed to creating a perfect storm. In the fall of 1902, a rural rebellion erupted in the northeast of Morocco, around Tezza, where tribes had been loudly expressing their fierce opposition to the first major reform plan that was enforced by Moulay Abdelaziz. This gave Bouhmara a chance to step in and to make a name for himself by challenging the Sultanate. So, in front of the crowd, Buhmara declared himself as Mulay Muhammad bin Hassan, the elder brother of the young Sultan, and claimed his right to the throne. For some context, Mulay Muhammad was the first son of the late Sultan Hassan I, who, like we mentioned previously, had died in 1894. Just so you know, the rule that currently applies in Morocco, which states that the oldest son is the rightful heir to the Sharifian throne, didn't come about until much later under King Mohammed V. His Majesty, الله يرحمه, introduced it to stabilize the throne and to prevent future crises like the one we're currently describing. So, after their father died in 1894, it wasn't clear which brother would become the ruler and which ones would just stay as princes. But some people close to the Sultanate weren't just gonna let a group of ulama decide who was gonna be the next commander of the faithful. Amongst these people, we had the ex-chamberlain, Bahmed, and the mother of Sultan Mulay Abdelaziz, Lalarqiya. A very expected duo in my book. Their schemes led to the imprisonment of the eldest son, Mulay Muhammad, in Meknes. After they took away all his belongings, only to leave him poor and alienated behind bars. But for Moroccans, Mulay Muhammad had simply been off the radar. Whether he was alive, dead, or on an entire different planet wasn't something they could testify, since only a handful of people in the high spheres of power could put a face on his name. That was the breach Buhmara needed to establish his scam. It was very simple. He would impersonate Mulay Muhammad. No. In the eyes of the world, he would be Mulay Muhammad. How hard could it be? The only people who knew about the scam would be the tribal leaders, the people that were sponsoring his rebellion. To them, he didn't try to hide his identity one bit. He exposed his strategy and promised that once he reached Fez, with their military support, he would be more than happy to step aside for any sharif that they choose to elect. Buhmara was almost wickedly upfront. My name is Jilali. This is my plan. Me personally, I think it would benefit all of us, and I need your help. So, are you in? And of course, we wouldn't be here wrapping up part one of this episode if the answer had been no.